From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Midnight Movie Cowboys. I am your host, Mr. Hunter Dusing, and with me in Colorado is Mr. John Grace. Say hi, John.
Hi, everybody. I am too handsome for this podcast.
Yes, he's a very good-looking man. John looks like a villain from a Hong Kong movie.
You know? Speaking in the terribly broken English dub.
Yes, exactly. Like, you know, he'd be dubbed over by some British guy.
Hey, this fried rice stinks!
This rice is my family.
Yip Man, your Wing Chun is inferior.
Yeah, they always had
that. The sick men of Asia!
Get him!
There's too much of that dialogue.
Yeah, no Stu this week. If you listen to our episode last week, Stu had microphone issues, so we're, you know, needing to get a new microphone. But this week, we're going to talk about one of my favorite children's movies, or family films, I should say. A Hong Kong picture by a man who is currently lighting the box office on fire in Asia, Mr. Stephen Chow.
Yes.
Director of such films you may have heard of as Kung Fu Hustle and Shaolin Soccer. He also did that Journey to the West movie. Did you see that?
Yeah, I watched a bootleg of it that I bought in Chinatown, and then it was dumped on Netflix like 3 months later.
What'd you think of it?
I liked it a lot. I thought it kind of fell apart in the end.
I just kind of thought it was okay. Like, I was like, yeah.
I like the first hour and a half, but you also have to understand, I've been watching Stephen Chow movies since 1991.
Right.
You know, like when I saw Tricky Brains in the theater and in Chinatown, and I was like, oh, this guy is, at that time, he had blown up almost overnight as the biggest star in Hong Kong and Taiwan.
Yeah, because I didn't get into him until 10 years later when Shaolin Soccer.
Now, keep in mind, his stuff was not released directly to mainland China consistently because they were still very limited on what they accepted from the Hong Kong market because Hong Kong was still a British colony, Red China was still Red China.
They were still murdering people on factory farms.
Right. And probably still are, but why not? I think they just make money and work them to death or something.
Yeah, they just work them to death building our iPhones.
They're on some crazy logic, but I've always been used to his style of humor. Garrow, our frequent collaborator, is a huge fan. We're big fans of that type of Mole Tao humor. It's real fast-talking Cantonese, visual puns. It doesn't always make sense. We call it non sequitur in this country. Journey to the West, the funny thing is he had the lead actress, Xu Kui, basically playing the Stephen Chow role. So he had,
well, yeah.
He sex reversed it where the female lead is actually doing all the Stephen Chow stuff. And
it kind of reminded me of like a Woody Allen movie where like Scarlett Johansson's playing the Woody Allen characters.
Right, but Xu Kui is a far better actress than Scarlett Johansson.
Oh, well, I know, but I'm just kind of...
Yeah, I mean, but she
reference.
Can handle the humor. She's basically doing all the Stephen Chow expressions and everything. And the funny thing is, I saw The Mermaid yesterday, which is getting this very limited, ooh, we're really afraid, we don't know how to market this movie release, by the same people who are giving you
And CJ7 was a movie that suffered similarly when it came
exactly.
out.
Exactly, and these are the same people who are giving you the Cat Lady Ghostbusters this summer. I saw The Mermaid, and in The Mermaid, the female lead is Jelly Lynn, that's her name. She's
don't get fat.
With a name like that, just don't.
Yeah, it's like I don't know if she's gonna stick with that name. Is that her name? I should probably like I was looking at the credits because I didn't know any of the actors because you know, it's like I'm not as familiar with mainland actors. They're getting a lot of actors from Beijing and stuff, and there's a lot of new young Hong Kong talent as well.
I just know them from like, because I took a Chinese film class in college, and we watched a lot of, like, mainland China, like, movies that were banned, you know?
Right.
So you saw a lot of, you know, Zhang Yimou and Chen
Kaige. It's all about Gong Li having a yeast infection.
Yeah, exactly. It's Gong Li, you know,
all this stuff I don't want to see because there's no Tiger Style or whatever.
Exactly. But, there was no a lot of it was like, you know, like sad commie movies like To Live and all that stuff. You know?
Right. Her name, and according to IMDb, verified it. My memory is correct. Jelly Lynn. And she's doing all the Stephen Chow routines and the Stephen Chow humor, and it works. And this movie is currently getting a very limited release. You have to check your local listings, and you actually have to find it sometimes listed on Fandango as Mei Rin Yu, the mermaid. They give it the Chinese title.
Wouldn't it typically be at the theaters? Because, like, in Dallas, we have theaters that, like, they're the big multiplexes, but they also have, like, the section for the, because, like, oh, this theater's in the Indian part of town. So
yeah, it's sort of like that, and I saw...
And so you see all the Bollywood movies there, you know?
I saw the Mermaid at the Arapahoe Crossing over in Aurora, and I hadn't been there in years. It used to be my regular multiplex, and apparently it's like a dumping ground for, like, Dimension movies that I didn't even know were coming out, like Dimension horror films and rap comedies and stuff, because there are all these posters around for these things I'd never heard of. Like, there's a new Amityville movie coming out with Jennifer Jason Leigh. I had no idea. And I guess they're showing like Chinese films over there regularly, and I remember there's actually a sizable Chinese population in that area, so maybe that's the reason for it. But it was on a big, nice screen. It was cool. Like, I liked the movie a lot. I would give it like a 9 out of 10. Like, I really liked it. And all these lazy comparisons to Splash are exactly that.
It's film critics today don't know shit about shit.
Nothing like that. It's nothing. It's not like any American film that's been made. There's one visual nod to Jaws, and that's it. It is a totally original film.
Stephen Chow references himself more often than...
Exactly.
You watch CJ7, he repeats stuff from Kung Fu Hustle.
This is what cracked me up. Like, the opening credits of The Mermaid, the theme song is a remix, re-recording of the theme from Fist of Fury, the Bruce Lee classic.
That's funny.
And I mean, it was amazing. And it was just like, I loved it. And it's getting, you know, Sony's just putting in a few theaters here and there and doesn't really know what to do with it.
Well, and so... Stephen Chow had a pretty sizable hit in America with Kung Fu Hustle, right?
And it didn't do that great in theaters. It did really great on video.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, it kind of, like, it was a pretty high-profile picture for him.
I talked to a lot of people who've seen it who I would never think ever would watch a Chinese
movie. Right, well, because I remember, like, it was kind of being marketed to the Tarantino crowd, to the Kill Bill crowd. Like, it was kind of being marketed like that. And a lot of people I know saw that movie. And, you know, I was a fan already because of Shaolin Soccer, which was bungled on release here. I saw it on a bootleg. I got it at a convention, but Kung Fu Hustle was, you know, I think it did pretty well for a foreign film in America.
It did decent. It was, I know that theater owners weren't crazy about it because the humor was too visual, and like it doesn't always make sense. It's illogical.
Like, you know, I was in college at the time, and everybody in college was going to see it and loving it and stuff.
Right. I saw it in an empty stadium theater over in Lakewood with there was like maybe a few, I don't know if they're high school or junior college kids behind me, and all we did was laugh.
Yeah, it's
falling out of our seats laughing.
It's a kind of humor that's timeless but is sort of out of style, which is the visual, like, Looney Tunes type humor.
Right. Because now we're in this phase where everything's a Judd Apatow comedy.
Everything's a stoner comedy, you know.
Everything's smart ass,
which
Seth Rogen crap,
which is what killed his Green Hornet movie. But
Yeah, but I was supposed to direct. There you go.
Yep, and he was supposed to play Kato too, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
but CJ7, I remember that came out, and you know, you've said before that it was marketed to the art house crowd when it should have been marketed as a family film.
Yeah,
and because like that was the movie he made right after Kung Fu Hustle, and it was kind of like Kung Fu Hustle was this kung fu comedy, and then you have CJ7, which is, you know, this thing. It just felt like they didn't know what to do with it, and it's this sort of, I think it's a really, it's, so what's the plot of the movie, John? Why don't you tell us the plot?
The plot is Stephen Chow is this overworked construction worker who is working to, he's really poor. He's extremely poor. And apparently there's a lot, if you live in China, there's a lot of references to that area and everything.
And isn't he based on Stephen Chow's own father?
based on his own dad, who I guess Stephen Chow claims that he grew up poor like that. So, and he said a lot of this is really the closest you'll get to a biopic of him. The father is working very hard, basically to send the kid to a private school, his son to a private school.
Yeah, like all the money goes to his education.
Like right. Everything. They live in a shack.
Yes.
It's the size of a bathroom.
And all of his clothes come from the dumpster.
Their food is rotten fruit.
And he goes to school with dirt on his face, and his teachers chastise him. They're like,
for amusement, they stomp roaches. It's just sad. And the son, played by a young girl, actually.
Oh, that's a girl?
Yes.
Are you fucking kidding me?
I'm not kidding. She does a fantastic job.
Oh, my God. I thought it was a boy.
No, it's a girl.
Wow.
But, they picked on for being the poor kid because all the kids going there are rich.
And they're hilarious. Like, that little rich kid with his, dog, he's like, this is the only one. The other one is owned by the daughter of the president of the United States. And he goes over to some kid and berates him. He's like, You are doomed to be a dwarf for the rest of your life. Get out of here. And he goes up to this fat girl and starts making fun of her. He's like, you should just kill yourself. You're so fat. And she's and it's this giant Hulk woman. And she's got this little girl voice. And when she runs off, the room shakes. It's like,
well, okay, here's the bully that the rich kid has throw our protagonist across the schoolyard.
Yes,
that was also played by a girl.
Really?
Yes, T-Rex. I here's the thing. I listened to the commentary, and the commentary is in Cantonese with subtitles. And by the way, the movie is dubbed in Mandarin. Stephen Chow
I could tell it was dubbed when I was. Yeah, I was watching in Mandarin, and I was like,
Stephen Chow said his traditional Mandarin dubber dubbed his voice and changed his voice a little to match the older Stephen Chow. It's like, by the way, the commentary is hilarious because it's basically Stephen Chow and his collaborators just busting on each other and making jokes.
I need to watch that
in Cantonese. It's really funny.
I just have the Sony Pictures Classics DVD though, so it's probably not on that, right?
No, it's on there.
Oh, it is? Okay, I need to
watch
it.
That's all I have. I thought about getting the Blu-ray, but I'm like, I introduced the movie to my son this morning. He's 6 years old. I loved it.
That makes me so happy that
It's the type of movie I can. And the English dub is actually very good. Like, I was surprised because I'm really down on the new dubs. I think they're really inferior, but this English dubbing was surprisingly really good. Like, the guy doing Stephen Chow's voice, it's kind of how Stephen Chow sounds in English, except without the broken English, but he sounds perfect, the vocal tone and everything. And, so the kid's picked on at school, and he's basically a young version of Stephen Chow.
Yeah.
And he always plays poor country bumpkin types who are kind of, misfits and outsiders and trying to fit in, and very inspired by Bruce Lee. There's a lot of visual little jokes to Bruce Lee movies.
Yeah, Kung Fu Hustle was that way.
Yeah, all of his films are like that. They always have at least one scene where somebody says, I don't want to fight, which is something Bruce always says in the Chinese films, but it's not as pronounced in the English dub versions. So the dad is looking for a toy for the kid.
He really wants a robot dog. Like,
yeah, he wants a robot dog.
Which is the most fucking retarded toy ever. Like, just get a dog, you know?
Right. And so he finds this, what he thinks is a balloon ball in the junkyard. And it's actually, there's been UFO sightings in the area. And it's actually a toy alien who's basically an alien dog. Which in the commentary, Stephen Chow is based on his own personal pet dog, a Pekingese, and he calls it CJ7 because that robot dog is called CJ1, and he thinks the alien dog has these magical powers. The little boy does.
My favorite part of the movie is his. Right,
I don't want to give anything away because I know a lot of people have not seen this film, but. Basically, the alien's powers are not quite what he wants them to be, but they're what he needs.
Yes.
So, the whole movie is with all the wild comedy and stuff, and kind of a real strong, what would you call it, pathos or whatever. You know, there's a lot of emotion in this film. There's still a real good moral lesson in the end for kids. You know, he can't depend on this dog to basically improve his life.
Well, and my favorite part of the film is, he finds this pet alien dog thing, and it has these powers, and he immediately thinks, okay, this dog is going to not only fix all my problems, but it's going to make me awesome.
Yeah, and it's like he thinks it's a genie.
Yeah, like, exactly. Like, he thinks it's a genie that's going to do whatever. So he has this elaborate fantasy about what the dog can do, and it, you know, turns him into this, like, secret agent type character.
Yeah, with visual references to Mission Impossible 2.
Yeah, Mission Impossible 2, and also Kung Fu Hustle.
Kung Fu Hustle, and everything, and gosh, maybe even sort of pre-Iron Man, Iron Man.
Yeah, it was very Iron Man-esque. But it was, and then when the dog can't do this, he gets very angry with it. And the movie sort of makes me think of a film that everyone loves that I don't love called Toy Story 3.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember everybody, I'm sure, will remember that when Toy Story 3 came out, it had a 99% rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah.
Because there was that one little percent named Armand White who didn't like it. And when I saw Toy Story 3, I thought, Armand White is right. And when I read his review. And the thing is, the Toy Story movies are movies that celebrate. He accused Toy Story 3 of being a film that celebrates consumerism. Mm-hmm. That, you know, because Toy Story 3 has this thing where it's like the toys are, you know, are the beauty of childhood. And, you know, you put it away and eventually you have to put the toys away and, you know, grow up because Andy has to go grow up. But, you know, and
yeah,
all that stuff, right?
Right.
But I think CJ7 kind of illustrates a more realistic relationship with material possessions, in that you kind of think if you just have this thing, it's going to, you know, make you happy. It's going to bring you happiness. And that's not necessarily the truth. But, like, but it's relationships that bring you happiness. And this this alien dog, he has a relationship with it. He develops a relationship, and it strengthens his relationship with his father. And it's a movie about the importance of that. And whereas a movie, CJ7 is a movie about toys, and that's why I compare it to Toy Story 3. But it's not a movie, but Toy Story is made by Disney.
Right.
And Disney is a company that wants you to buy their shit.
They're selling you shit.
They are a company that's in the toy business. They're in the doll business. So they're going to make a movie like Toy Story. And Toy Story 3 is a well-written, well-made movie. I'm not disputing that. But
right.
I don't think its message is – its message is – Armand White is absolutely right. He's mm-hmm. It's a movie that celebrates consumerism. It's a movie that celebrates buying stuff. And
right.
these fit – things you buy will bring you happiness, which is false. It's just not true. I am a person who collects things, and I will be the first to tell you that it's not a source of happiness. It's just something I like.
The same thing here.
But a lot of people kind of think that material possessions bring happiness, and they don't. Yeah. It's relationships that bring happiness. And I think CJ7 is a movie that illustrates that point. It's not material possessions. You may think it is, but it's not. Because it's relationships. Mm-hmm. And that's what I loved about this film, is that it makes that point. Like, the first time I saw it, I kind of got misty-eyed. I was like, this is such a touching film.
Yeah.
About, like, sacrifice and relationships and, you know, fathers and sons and all that. And I saw it. And the reason I compare it to Toy Story 3 is not only thematically, but because I saw them around the same time.
Right, right.
And so it was kind of like a weird coincidence. Like, I saw this around when Toy Story 3 came out.
Right, it's a real father and son movie, which we don't see often in out of Hollywood, because everybody hates their dad in Hollywood.
It's Hollywood's more about the single mother.
And, yeah, it's all about the single mother.
And celebrating
every screenwriter's parents divorced when he was like 8.
Yeah, exactly.
So
nobody comes from an intact family.
No, not at all. Please, all these just ridiculously stupid films coming out of Hollywood. It's
I did my list for the year, 4 movies. I said I can't do a top 10 because I didn't see 10 movies that made an impression on me.
Right.
You know, I'm sure there were other good movies out there that I didn't see. Like, I haven't seen Kingsman yet. I haven't seen, you know, there were some you told me to see that I missed. But I was just like, I didn't see 10 films that moved me or, you know, blew me away. I saw 4, you know, like, whereas any other year I could give you 10 films. It might be a little work, but I was like, this last year was so bad.
It was terrible, and I skipped the Marvel movies, and it was still a bad year.
Yeah, you know, the best one was Ant-Man, and that was just kind of okay, you know.
Still haven't seen it.
It's all right
because I could already tell everybody was overrating it.
It's not bad. It's not great, but it's way better than Age of Ultron. Holy shit!
That's kind of how I am though these days. Like, do I want to waste my time on something that's not bad?
Exactly.
You know, time is so precious to watch a movie or whatever, or sit down. Right. It's like, maybe I'd rather watch something I really like.
It's so funny. Know? Like, I was thinking, like, when I went to the theater last year, I mostly went to see older movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
same here. I saw Ace in the Hole. I saw Shaolin and Wu-Tang. I saw lots of old classics because got an Alamo nearby. So it's like, I don't really have to see new stuff.
Yeah, I got an Alamo. I've got the Texas Theater. You know, it's just... You know, I can see all kinds of stuff.
I'm seeing some of the, like, 3 old movies on Saturday.
Yeah.
At the Alamo. It's like, there's like a double feature of James Ellroy hosting Rare Noirs.
I'm so jealous that you just.
Why do I have to see anything new? It's like, it doesn't matter, you know? But I watched, like, CJ7. It's got a lot of heart. It actually portrays the little kid, Dickie. That's the character's name. It's like he's accurately portrayed the way kids really behave.
Yes.
It's very rare in films.
Yes.
Whenever you watch something like Big with Tom Hanks, they act like kids act like what baby boomers think kids act like.
Yes.
So they sing songs that kids don't do that. They're like cheerful wearing their baseball caps. Kids just don't act like that.
No, in this movie, like, a lot of the kids are dicks.
Yeah, they're assholes.
And they're not dicks in the, like, American bully type way. They're assholes just in the, like, you can tell their parents a prick and that's why they're a prick.
Right, right. They're cutthroat.
And I can tell you that, like, when you teach school and stuff, you can definitely see a lot of the parents and kids, you know.
Yeah.
Just their parents' personalities bleed into them so much.
Right, right.
Especially around election season.
But
The kid who's a dick, like, you can tell his dad's like that, you know?
Yeah, well, it's like there's a scene where, because CJ7 doesn't deliver on what Dickie thinks he can do.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Jesus.
Dickie is horrible to him.
Oh, he's awful. But
that's the way kids really are. They're impulsive and they don't think.
And they have, they're very, like, their anger can sometimes run up amok, you know? Like, it's wrath. You know?
Because kids are emotionally irrational.
They haven't learned to regulate their emotions yet.
Not at all, no.
Like, God, you know, you go to, like, kids in middle school, and it's like they're learning to be independent, but they don't know how to regulate it yet, so they just say everything that comes to their mind. It's crazy.
Right, right. The mind-mouth connection is a little too, it's a little too impulsive. You know, it's a little too fast. But yeah, it's like, this is the only... I have to watch a lot of these family films because I have a kid. This is the only one that really captures the way kids behave.
Yeah. No, it's...
I don't see any that really capture that real... Because they always act like kids are perfect little angels. It's just not true.
I know, and it's definitely not true. And that's just what's... But the thing about this movie is that it still feels magical. You know?
Right.
It manages to have that level of, like, magical fantasy, but it's also extremely honest and realistic. It's not trying to sell you something. It's not trying to, you know, sugarcoat anything. Like, it's actually a pretty upsetting movie at times.
Yeah, I was kind of iffy about how my 6-year-old might react to it. Because there's some scenes that a lot of soccer mom types would probably freak out at.
Mm-hmm.
But no, he loved it. He totally got it. You know, he was asking questions about certain scenes and everything, but he totally got it. He understood what it was doing and how there's, you know, there's still a rainbow at the end and everything.
I mean, the ending of the movie, it's a very happy ending, even though, like, it kind of has a you know, a tragedy in there. But
I think it, honestly, I think it blows away E.T., which is his obvious inspiration. But
yeah, it is very
E.T. The kids in E.T. act like a smart aleck baby boomers.
I never liked E.T. I'm sorry. Even when I was a kid, it's not a movie I have any nostalgia for. Like
I saw it. I had to see it twice because my family liked it so much, and there wasn't anything out to see that summer except Rocky III. Sorry, folks. Conan the Barbarian was already yanked from theaters. Yeah. By then. Arnold didn't take over Hollywood like he. Yeah. The bios would have you believe.
Yeah, but, I know. You would think that from media, but
you know. Right, and it's like You know, it's like there's things I liked about it, but there was a lot of illogical stuff in it, and I didn't think the kids really behaved the way kids really behave. And there's
somebody was telling me, "Oh, E.T.'s playing at the theater. Are you going to go see it?" And I said, "No. I don't have any nostalgia for it." I said, "When I was a kid, if the alien wasn't killing and eating people, not interested."
You know? Right. And
like, give me John Carpenter's The Thing. Give me Alien. You know, give me all that stuff.
Funny thing is, it's like Alien. John Carpenter's The Thing and Blade Runner were the huge flops that year.
Yeah, they were.
Massive bombs. They're the ones everybody talks about. Nobody talks about E.T. anymore.
No, because it's, you know, it's...
the trend.
This nice little, like, lump of shit walking around in the woods.
Exactly.
You know?
I strongly preserve, or you know, just it's like, okay, CJ7, that's what a boy and his alien thing should be.
Yeah.
And it's like, and they learn real lessons. I don't remember what the lesson is in E.T. You hear Christ peril. Parallels and stuff, but
it's that the government's racist or something.
How bombastic and you know overbearing and in your face with loud noises and stuff can you be? And it's like I'll take CJ7 over ET any day.
Yeah, it is a movie that like it was almost too much at times. How you know, moving, I thought it was.
It hits certain emotional touchstones you have from when you're a child. Like the first scene where Dickie is dancing with CJ7 and you hear Boney M's Sonny.
Yes!
Their cover of Sonny on the soundtrack. It's like, that's the feeling you have like when you get a new animal. Or when you're a kid, you get a pet, you get a dog. Or kitten or whatever. It's like that's that joy you feel when you have your it's probably the best movie about having a pet.
Yeah, it really is, because I was gonna say like I initially thought of it as a movie about toys.
Yeah,
but it's kind of an anti-toy movie. It's a movie about how a pet is more fulfilling.
Right,
because
like,
you go through that joy of like loving it and caring for it, and you also go through the loss.
Yeah, you know, and also being frustrated with it, too.
Being frustrated. Oh, of course.
He captures every spectrum of human emotion of owning a pet in that film.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's like, that's why I always say he's really the only filmmaker I care about these days. He's the only one who is dependable for something
that you're like, have the auteurist.
Right. He's really like it's unique. You're getting something new. It's not like anything you've seen before, even if you take an old story like The Monkey King and make Journey to the West, he still does it in a way nobody else would do it.
Yeah, and that's the thing about Stephen Chow is, like, it was weird. Oh, excuse me. Because you get into him with Shaolin Soccer and then Kung Fu Hustle, and you go, okay, I know what to expect from this guy.
Right.
Then he makes CJ7. What? Totally different.
Yeah.
Then he makes Journey to the West. Even though I didn't really love Journey to the West, but it's still like a complete... I'm like, wow, he did something totally different with this film.
Right.
Like,
I was expecting another...
I was expecting Kung Fu Hustle again.
I was expecting Monkey King, Pigsy, and all that stuff.
Yeah, I was expecting Dragon Ball Z, but...
Yeah, it would be like Monkey War, or New Pilgrims to the West, or, you know, Journey... You know, there's been a lot of those movies, and no, it was nothing like any of them. And he did something new with it. And I think he was supposed to do the sequel. He didn't want to. He's like, I want to do something different. So he did The Mermaid.
He's producing the sequel, isn't he?
Supposedly. And it's like, really, it's hands off. I don't think they're continuing his way.
He was a producer on Dragon Ball Evolution, boy.
Right. What does that mean, you know?
What is clearly nothing, because that movie sucked. I saw that in the theater, really, and I was like, I saw it in the theater because, you know, I loved the show when I was younger, and I was like, I have to see this train wreck. And I went to the theater, and I saw this kid with his mom in there, and I was like, I have a feeling this kid's about to experience what I experienced when I saw when I saw like Super Mario Brothers in the theater, not Mortal Kombat, because Mortal Kombat was actually kind of fun. What was another horrible piece of shit from my childhood? I don't know, but you would see these film adaptations that just like didn't get it. You know, like Super Mario Brothers. Like,
oh, yeah.
The Super Mario Brothers, it's like, wait a second. They were trying to make, like, Blade Runner, I guess? This is not Super Mario Brothers.
I never saw it. I never had to endure that stuff. Luckily, I'd outgrown those type of movies.
Yeah, I was the right age. So
I was totally into renting Charles Bronson movies and stuff.
Right. No, I was a little kid. Like, my dad took me to see Super Mario Brothers, and I was like, what the fuck? Like,
yeah. My problem with stuff like that is it's always I'm trying to relive the joy I had seeing Inframan, and nothing ever really measures up. So, and so with Stephen Chow's movies, I actually feel like this is something if I saw as a kid, I would just would have blown me away. do we have to take a break for a commercial pause?
Oh yes.
Okay, so we're due for that.
Anyway, well, let's take a quick break, word from our sponsor,
right,
and we will be right back. Okay, so that was great. Sponsors, aren't they awesome, John?
Yeah, they're the best.
Yeah, we love...
We gotta cut an ad one of these days.
We love making money.
Because people who don't listen to us, they really want ads from us, so, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But,
I'm sure a lot of people signed up for True Vehicle a few weeks ago.
but with CJ7, it's hard to explain to people how good this sort of thing is until you see it. And I remember when I bought my used copy at Second Spin in Denver, the clerk was like, "This is such a great movie." And he had like a purple mohawk.
You know? Nice.
So he looked like a mugger from a Marvel comic in 1983. But
those are the best.
Yeah, they were always the punk rocker muggers. But it's just like it's a movie that those who've seen it like really love it. I know Garo's not a huge fan because Garo wants tricky brains again and again. You know, he wants that old Mole Tal humor.
I was actually kind of wondering if we should get him on here, but because he's such a Stephen Chow fan, but I didn't know.
I don't even know if he owns the movie. He will probably, if he doesn't own it right now, he probably will. Soon, since I mentioned the commentary that's in Cantonese, that's almost like a Stephen Chow movie in itself. Listen to it because he just tells jokes. I mean, he'll explain the scene, but he'll be like he's asked by one of his co-stars, the guy who plays the boss in the movie, the construction foreman, his name is something like they call him Fatso Chung.
Really?
Yeah, or Fatso Lam or something. He's Chi Chung Lam in the credits, but his actual name is Fatso. That's what they call him. So they're joking with each other. Like the guy who played the teacher, the very cruel teacher who's like picking his nose and stuff.
He's in all the Stephen Chow movies.
Right, he's one of the collaborators. And so they're just batting jokes back and forth. But they ask Stephen Chow, they're like, "Did you research like the migrant workers, you know, to get an idea of what it's like to be like them?" He goes, "Yes, I did. I spent a couple of days talking to them, but I just couldn't understand them. I'm too handsome." You know, it's just the... So the Cantonese track, the Cantonese commentary track, which is, thankfully they provided subtitles, is just as fun as the movie. I mean, it's just like, there's your Mole Tal Stephen Chow comedy with the commentary, because it's just a riot. Like, he'll act like he was like in the department store scene where they're looking at the CJ1 robot dog. He points out that in the back, behind a shelf, is Vincent, what's his name? The co-writer of the film Vincent Koch, or I guess you might say it Vincent Coe,
Vincent Koch is more fun to say, right?
Right. And Stephen Chow was like, Vincent, he wanted to talk. I think he wanted to talk to that girl he's talking to, so he hung around. And he's in the background of the scene, like he's making all these jokes about that. And then he said when he's like hitting Dickie, when his character is hitting Dickie, he goes, I actually hit her, and I told her I was going to hit her, and I don't think she understood what acting was all about. And then she understood. He goes, she's crying. She cried and didn't talk to me for 2 days and told her mother. He says, but she has to understand what acting is like. And I think he's joking the whole time, but he's just, they're having a blast with it. It's a great commentary. It's not John Carpenter telling you what's going on the screen.
The worst commentaries are always, yeah, this is the part where I punched the camel.
This is where I'm putting the wet towel on my head. So
yeah. They pulled the rubber baby bunky bumpers.
He's a robot cab driver.
You know, like Friedkin, sometimes his commentaries will be really good, and then sometimes he's just like, so this part is the scene where Father Karras realizes blah, blah, blah. It's like, shut the fuck up! I don't care!
We know, and it's like...
I'm watching the film! I don't need you to tell me what's going on!
And Stephen Chow Sing Chi and his crew are basically... they're telling you all this technical stuff about the movie. Like, it was real difficult for the girl playing Dickie to basically, she's interacting with nothing. They didn't even have a stand-in tennis ball or motion thing or whatever. These kids are just looking at air.
Yeah.
And acting with air and to fill it in. He goes, I had to ever look higher. And like he's explaining all the technical stuff too, and how they found like a neighborhood that was being demolished in that Xinzhou province or whatever, and it's like that's where they filmed, and how they converted one building into the studio for what was supposed to be Dickie and his father's apartment or home. And it's just everything, or why he picked certain music. I haven't gotten to the part where he explains, including Sunny by Boney M., but I know from an interview he said that was his favorite song when he was a kid.
Well, there you go. There's the autobiographical part.
Right, but he explains why he uses certain music cues, and you know, of course, the shock that a lot of the kid actors are actually girls playing boys. And
well, that Sarah, when you told me that, and I clicked on Zhu Jiao, who plays Dickie, and there it is, it's a girl, you know, like bangs and hair, and I was like, oh my gosh.
And I had no idea when I saw it in the theater for the first time.
No, so. I didn't know till you told me. I was like,
and I'm glad to see she's still acting.
Yeah, she's still in stuff, yeah.
She's been doing stuff, which I'm really glad to see.
I think it was her first movie.
It was. She was good. Yeah, she was actually in a Mulan live action.
Yeah, how appropriate.
And she played a character named Dickie in something called Just Another Pandora's Box, which I'm wondering if that was sort of, I mean, in Hong Kong, they're kind of known, which of course looks exactly like, it looks like a fake Kung Fu Hustle sequel directed by Jeff Lau. With a lot of familiar things. So it's probably like a pop culture in joke that she's called Dickie again.
Could be.
I'll have to see it eventually somehow.
But I do notice that, but I did see like, you know, he has a lot of those actors that he uses in a lot of movies. Like there's the fat dude who's in all of his movies. There's, you know, that teacher who's always like kind of a skinny dude shouting at people.
Right. I think Garrow would complain that he doesn't work with Ng Man Dot anymore, who was his co-star in a bunch of comedies in the 90s. And I think he's in Shaolin Soccer. And supposedly Ng Man Dot has complained that Stephen Chow only cares about money, doesn't care about collaborating with anybody. And I also figure it's like, okay, they work together a lot. It doesn't necessarily mean they're friends.
Oh, of course not. No.
And I think it's something nobody really understands about movies.
Or music. Music.
It's a job.
Like, here's the thing. A band is a business. That's what it is. Like, the people in the Eagles, like, Glenn Frey probably hadn't talked to any of them in years before he died. They just would go out on stage and play and leave.
Right. But Don Felder said he couldn't stand those guys.
Yeah.
And it's because they're your coworkers. It's like you get so tired of them. And there's always this, oh, let's blame Yoko Ono for the breakup of the Beatles.
Which they didn't fucking like each other.
That's just flat out racism. It's like, no. You know, it's like they didn't get along.
Is it racism or is it just sexism?
You know what? It's kind of, oh, this Jap wife. And it's like, come on. It's like they couldn't stand each other.
No, they didn't like each other. It's just nothing to do with Yoko.
It's like, God, they played like 1,000 times in Germany together and hated each other. It's like, come on. It's like it's your coworkers. Do you have to be friends with all
well,
your
it's
coworkers?
Like, I follow Billy Duffy on Facebook, the guitarist for The Cult.
Yes.
I have never seen him post a picture with of him outside of like maybe a concert shot of him and Ian Astbury.
Yeah, they can't stand each other.
Of course they hate each other. I mean, the band's been broken up and back together. When he posts a lot of pictures, and he has never posted a picture that I have seen of him with Ian Astbury off stage. You know, they just...
Why would they?
you know, they're not friends. You know, right. It's just one of those.
And I think Stephen Chow gets along with his collaborators and eventually gets tired. You know, people get tired of him and he gets tired of them. You know, and he probably is. And this is something I noticed watching The Mermaid, because it is so overflowing with ideas. And I was thinking, God, I almost feel like when he was working on all those Wong Jing comedies of the 90s with director Wong Jing, he must have been really frustrated, because I think he was probably overflowing with gag ideas he could not execute on the screen.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he was just all this stuff he probably wanted to do and couldn't do and didn't want to do it for Wong Jing and Charles Hung's company at the time. It's just like he was saving them. And this is the odd thing is like, and we've probably mentioned this on the show before, Garo and I have a mutual friend who met him in Hong Kong. He was living with his sisters and mother.
Is that like a cultural thing, though?
It was sort of cultural. It was in the 90s. He was top of the box office. He was number one star. He was bigger than Jackie Chan. And the funny thing is, I read up on one of his bios that basically he was investing in real estate like crazy. And when after 2000, apparently he just cashed in and he was probably the richest entertainer in Hong Kong.
Yeah, because I know he's like one of the biggest names over there. And
he was a really smart guy. I think he's a really intelligent guy.
And he just, Hollywood just couldn't fucking buy a clue with him.
No, they have no idea, because they want everything to fit in a certain A, B, C pattern that they think that's all Americans can understand, and they don't know what to do with somebody like that. And he doesn't need them. He makes up for it. No. The Mermaid, Garo was pointing out today, he goes, The Mermaid's going to gross $600 million worldwide.
Yeah.
Because that Ghostbusters piece of shit, it'd be lucky if it breaks $200 million worldwide, globally.
Worldwide. And it'll be – good thing they have sexism to blame it on.
Exactly. They'll blame it on the patriarch and misogynist and Jim Goad and Gavin McGinnis.
Jim Goad.
And Anthony Cumia and all these guys. They'll point the finger.
By the way, go look at the title for Jim Goad's new column that just went up. It's pretty funny. And by the way, it's a question, and the answer is yes. I can tell you as a history major, the answer is yes. Anyway.
Oh, gosh. But yeah, it's just like, this is a type of talent. And to me, he's a real filmmaker. It's like, when you watch Kung Fu Hustle, it looks like Martin Scorsese directing a Chinese comedy.
Oh, yeah.
Every shot is, like, perfect. Everything looks visually sweeping. It's amazing.
He's brilliant as a guy, like, a guy who can act and direct in his own stuff. He just...
Right.
Like, you look at a movie like Kung Fu Hustle and then a movie like CJ7, and it's like, oh, my gosh. I can't believe this guy, because, you know, I saw Shaolin Soccer and Kung Fu Hustle. I was like, oh, this guy's great at making me laugh. And I see CJ7, and I'm like, why am I crying? He's not supposed to do this, too.
What, son of a bitch?
Yeah.
It's like Armand White said that in a better world, Stephen Chow would be acclaimed way above Paul Thomas Anderson.
Of course!
He says he's a far better director and actually understands humanity and emotions way better. Yeah, Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Paul, I think a lot of the bloom's off the rose with old PTA after Inherent Vice. I don't even think people who claim to like that movie really like it.
They just like to say it to be daring.
Because, you know, I saw that. That is one of the very few times I've walked out of a movie. I just was like...
Well, you know, from the get-go with Boogie Nights and that casino drama he did before that, he was always pushed as a pompous ass.
Yeah. Yeah.
New Altman, new Scorsese. It doesn't happen that way.
Mm-mm. And yeah, I like Boogie Nights. I mean, that's a fun movie, but...
I don't care for it. It's actually the only other film to use Boney M's cover of Sonny on the soundtrack.
Yep, yes, it did.
Yes, and here's the funny thing. Boney M was not even a successful disco act in the U.S. They never pushed him.
Mm-mm.
They had one hit with By the Rivers of Babylon. They did a cover of that, and that was it. That, like, Sonny was not pushed on the radio because apparently the German producer, Frankie Farian, who later gave us Milli Vanilli, said, I don't need to push Boney in America because I'm making so much money everywhere else. And he also knew he couldn't have them tour because they didn't always do their own singing on those tracks.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you see Boney M, it's a very visual act. They're lip-syncing and stuff, and you know, Frankie Farian's doing some of the voices, and it was like Milli Vanilli. It's like you couldn't have them tour. They'd have to be lip-synced on the tours and stuff. So, but Boney M was huge in Asia, like gigantic. You mention them to somebody in Hong Kong or Taiwan, and they're like, oh, yeah, Boney M. And I'm watching old Chewy Hark films where they're making jokes about Boney M.
Yeah,
so
that, it's kind of funny how that those little, like, things. It's just, it's so odd how things can get big in Asia, like Anvil.
Yeah.
Well, this is odd because I had a Filipino coworker that she told me that Sister Sledge was gigantic in the Philippines.
Really?
Yeah, the Disco Act Sister Sledge, huge.
Speaking of the Philippines, totally unrelated.
Uh-huh.
But my dad was telling me today that, you know, somebody went to the Philippines and had to be picked up by somebody, and he said that at the time, this was pre-internet, that the government did not allow people to have maps of the Philippines.
What?
And that was their way of controlling people.
Wow. How did Canon Films make so much stuff there?
Because for some reason, like, you had to be guided by a government person if you wanted to go somewhere. And it was because the Philippines were so confusing, and there were so many roads, and there were so many islands. It was the government's way of controlling the people, apparently.
Jeez.
By withholding maps from them.
It's funny because now it is a very popular military retirement spot because to retire in the Philippines, all you need is $100,000 in the bank. Really? You have to put it in, because a friend of mine looked into it. You only have to put $100,000, but I think it has to be in a government-sponsored bank, but you can retire in the Philippines. Like,
really?
your money goes real far. Like, the dollar goes really far there.
No.
Like, people said the mistake was the Philippines was offered statehood by the U.S., and they turned it down. And they said that was actually the dumbest thing they ever did.
Hmm.
Because it would have been like Guam. It would have been like this U.S. territory that would use dollars instead of whatever the Filipino money is. Mm-hmm. And now they just have a terrible economy dependent on their farming and basically the military bases.
Yeah.
They're U.S. military bases.
And
so
their big ceremony where they crucify people at Easter.
Right. They're extremely they're extremely Roman Catholic.
Very like, Catholic you know, country.
If you bring drugs into the country, this is for all you stoners, you'll be executed.
The president of the Indonesia, who's the big metalhead guy.
No, I haven't heard of him.
Widodo is his name. He became president of like Indonesia or something, and like, you know, he was always wearing Napalm Death t-shirts and like giving the horns in pictures.
That's kind of awesome.
Yeah, it is. But then some Australians brought heroin into the country, and they were up for execution. And so Napalm Death and these Carcass and these bands were appealing for him to, you know, let them off the hook. And they got executed.
In the name of metal, bro. The Aussies.
Yeah, so they
bro,
were like,
you have broken the metal code.
So
you are
like,
not cool.
So, exactly. So they were like, this guy's not a real fan. Yeah.
He is not metal. Metal is not about executions.
Even though, like...
metal is not about capital punishment. Well, maybe with Slayer it is, but it's
maybe
not
it's,
about capital punishment.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Kerry King's really into capital punishment.
Kerry King is the most right-wing guy worse than Ted Nugent. Yeah. He makes Ted Nugent look like a liberal.
He does. Kerry King's pretty, like, if you listen to the song Payback by Slayer, and it's a total screed against liberals. It's like...
Well, you know, I know what I'm going to be posting week of election.
Oh my god, it's like fucking progress. Watch me fucking regress. Kerry King said he would play Rush Limbaugh in like the tour van to like piss people off and stuff.
Oh, I know. What's funny is all these morons. If you go to the Ditto Head YouTube page, they think it's an anti-Rush.
Oh, I know. It's like, no, it's not. Kerry King gave an interview saying how he's a big Rush fan and that it's a pro.
Yeah.
Like the song is the anger of the average Rush Limbaugh listener that he feels.
Yeah.
You know
exactly.
Like, which this is boy, how I feel because I'm a Ditto.
Boy, you're gonna hear about that to death in the next 6 months because boy, we're about to go overload on social media outrage over the way things are.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just like the Philippines. If you have $100,000, you can retire there.
Interesting. Well,
yeah.
Start saving, everybody.
And girls are pretty there, so
yep.
Like, so a lot of old military guys.
I need to go find a nice Catholic girl there and
yeah, it's like, well, I don't know about nice, but yeah, they're very, very Catholic.
go nail me to a cross when they get there.
Right. But yeah. And I mean, they have some terrific martial arts styles to get into if you like stick fighting.
Oh, sure. Who doesn't?
Yeah. It's where Danny Inosanto is the great pioneer of bringing all the Filipino stick fighting arts over in this country. Him and Remy Priestess.
Do you have anything else to add about CJ7?
See it?
Yeah.
I'm actually thinking about trying to see if I could find the Hong Kong disc for a low price, because Stephen Chow apparently does his voice in the Cantonese version.
Okay.
So I may actually seek that out just for the Stephen Chow voice, which is pretty funny on its own.
And it's good to watch with the kids, apparently.
Cause... The English dub, like I said, is really well done, and I'm not a fan of any post-1988 English dubs on Hong Kong movies or Chinese films, but this works. It's actually really well done. My son loved it. Asking me all these questions about the logic of it. Why did Dickie's dad, you know, why did that happen to him on the construction site and all this stuff? So I'm getting all these kind of questions where I have to explain, okay, we'll watch it again and then you can figure it out, you know, because I am, you know, when you have kids, they have a tendency to want to know everything before they see it.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, no, you're going to watch it and you're going to find out.
It's insane the questions kids come up with, like teaching history.
Yeah.
It's like, I never even fucking thought of that. Like, you know? It's like, why are you asking me this? This is not something anybody thinks of.
All right. Curious kids are smart, though. So.
They are. No, it's funny because it's always the ones who are really intelligent that ask the craziest fucking questions, you know?
Exactly. Oh, and by the way, if your kid really loves it and he's young enough or she is young enough where they still like plushy stuffed animals or whatever... There is a CJ7 plushie available on Amazon from a Chinese dude.
So they are trying to sell something. God damn it.
This is the only thing they ever released. This is the funny thing. There is an animated sort of follow-up to this that came out that has Stephen Chow's voice on it. It's an animated film. And it's a CJ7, the animated movie. It's never been released in the U.S. You have to get it from Asia or your local Chinese bootleg dealer.
Okay. Yeah, I knew there was a cartoon, but I didn't know anything about
it. I have it. It's an animated film. It's a cartoon. It's fun. It's not as good as the live-action film, but it's fun. And obviously it was made to kind of, you know, I guess there was demand for a sequel, and Stephen Chow, as we can tell, really doesn't like to do sequels. Mm-hmm. He just has no interest in them. Like, it was supposed to be a Kung Fu Hustle, too. He never did it.
Yeah, I remember hearing that there was going to be one. And
I don't think he wants to, and he's like in his 50s now. He doesn't want to do that type of stuff, so it's like... You know, he's not like Jackie Chan, where he's clinging on, trying to look like a young man in his 60s.
He's like, oh, let's do Rush Hour 6.
this is something I'm going to say about Jackie Chan, other than his communist ass-kissing that he's done in the last decade. Here's the funny thing. For years, everybody's saying, now it's time for him to be the Simon Yuen and play the Sam the Seed role and bring in new protégés into the genre. He's never done it. Doesn't want to pass the torch. Wants to be the top guy in his 60s. It's crazy.
He still wants to be Jackie, the guy in Police Story.
Exactly. Stephen Chow, if you watch Kung Fu Hustle, 80% of the movie he's out of the spotlight and he hands it over to Yuen Hua and the actress who played the landlady and stuff.
Oh yeah, this movie, CJ7, it's the kids. It's the kids and the little CGI animal.
It's the kids. He's always in Journey to the West. He's not in front of the camera.
In Journey to the West, he's not in it at all. Like, in fact, he was supposed to be the monkey king. I was like, where's Stephen Chow? I want to see Stephen Chow.
He didn't want to be in front of the camera. He doesn't want to anymore. In The Mermaid, he doesn't even cameo.
I heard he's not in that either.
What's funny is Chewy Hark has a small role.
Oh, really?
It's like, I thought that was hilarious. And
that's funny.
But it's like, I think he's just not interested in performing anymore. And you know what? I respect it. It's like he understands his age. He doesn't think anybody wants to see him with gray hair. And he's not dyeing his hair like Jackie does. He's let it go gray.
Yeah, because I've noticed when I see pictures of Stephen Chow, he's just letting his hair go. Like, he's not trying to trick you into thinking he's younger.
Right, and I respect that. It's like, he's cool, he's aging gracefully, and he's always been one of the coolest actors, and definitely, like, the best, you know, Hong Kong talent of the last, like, 25 years. And if you got a guy who's equally inspired by Michael Hui and Jackie Chan and Bruce Lee, it's a good thing. Yeah. The funny thing is, Donnie Yen, when Garo and I interviewed him, supposedly there was like a rumor coming out of Hong Kong that Donnie Yen was going to do a movie with Stephen Chow, and I don't remember, Garo might actually remember the real details on this, but either Donnie Yen was supposed to play Yip Man. Stephen Chow was supposed to play Bruce Lee. Or it was vice versa, but it was about the Bruce Lee-Yip Man relationship. And this is in 1995 or 96. And Kara mentions it to him, and Donnie Yen's like, how did you know about that? So it's like, because they didn't realize a lot of the movie project gossip got over. But that film was never made because, you know, by that time, Stephen Chow was huge and Donnie Yen was just kind of this B-level guy doing movies as favors for Wong Jing and Filipino producers and such. But yeah, he was kind of in a purgatory, movie purgatory for a while in Hong Kong. But Stephen Chow was just top of the box office. But also, you can find some of these movies on Netflix. Like they've got Out of the Dark running right now, which is one of his mid-90s comedies, sort of a spoof on Leon the Professional. And I think Shaolin Soccer pops up every now and then.
Yep.
Also, Journey to the West, I believe, is available last time I looked. But, you know, those are worth catching up on. But CJ7, I've never seen on the streams for free. You can get the DVD for nothing. Yeah, it's like hell on Amazon.
Yeah, I got it for cheap.
Yeah, it's like I think it's as cheap as 48 cents brand new. Yeah, you know, as of this, by the time the show airs, maybe we'll increase the value. There'll be this demand. But the Blu-ray is like $6 if you're Amazon Prime.
Yeah, that's when I have the DVD. I don't think I'll upgrade it to Blu-ray, but, you know.
No, I might get a Hong Kong DVD or Blu-ray if it has a Cantonese track because I'm interested. But, mm-hmm. you know, that's something for me. I'm a deeper fan.
Yeah, you're bigger into it than the average Joe.
Not the average Joe who just wants a new movie every other day. Right. You know, it's like I look at the old stuff. I look at old early 70s Hong Kong films nobody else would bother to look at. So,
right.
You know, because I'm looking for things, you know. I'm trying to form a history here. But, mm-hmm. What do you want to give our ratings here?
Yeah. I was curious what your rating was. What is it?
I give it a 9. Maybe even a 10.
I'm going full 10 for me.
Fuck it. I'll do my elbows. Fuck it. I'll give it a 10.
I mean, I think it's a very emotionally mature family film that's
right.
very that has a lot of wisdom that most movies lack.
And right, it is. It's one of the best in a long time, and it's definitely. Yeah, it's a 10 because I watched it this morning, and even English dubbed 6 years later, still effective.
Comes through.
Still really effective. I even appreciated some of the thematic stuff a lot more than I did
like
the first time I saw it.
You know, and it took me a while to sit down and watch it back when I first saw it, because, I mean, I saw it around when Toy Story 3 came out, and the movie had been out for a while at that point.
Right.
I had it on DVD, and I just didn't get around to watching it because I was just like, eh, you know, it looks like a kid's movie, whatever. You know, I was like, just, you know, couldn't be bothered. And then when I watched it, I was like, this is the best Stephen Chow movie I've seen, you know.
Right.
I was like, I couldn't believe how good it was. And coming off of a movie like Toy Story 3, which just didn't sit right with me. And it's not because, you know, I read Armand White's review. It was just because I was kind of like, you know, that was a well-made movie, but something's not right about it.
Well, there's something weird and tacky sort of about bringing to mind the Holocaust at World War II.
Yeah, exactly. When you're doing it, it is very much like Toy Story 3 is like Schindler's List with toys.
Why? You know? Why? Yeah, oh, the funny thing is, everybody was praising Inside Out last summer,
which I didn't see.
I saw it with my son. It was okay. I mean, it's creative. I was surprised our animation hasn't advanced much in a decade. But funny thing is, we went to see The Good Dinosaur at second run, and you kept hearing how bad it was. I thought it was way better than Inside Out.
I'm just not a big Pixar guy.
No, and I'm not big on it either, but God, it's more tolerable than what DreamWorks throws at me. And
no, yeah. And here's the thing. I acknowledge that Pixar has very talented people working for it.
Yeah.
And that their movies are well written, well made. Like, you know, they have the guy, you know, who did John Carter does movies for them, and he's brilliant, you know.
Right.
But I'm just not a big animated movies guy. Like,
yeah,
especially CG. And I love cartoons, but I don't love CGI animated stuff. For some reason, it just doesn't connect with me.
Yeah, it's hard for me to get much out of it.
I don't invest in it the way I should. And, you know, I watch something like Up, and I'm like, you know, wow, that's really well made. But
I never want to watch it again.
If you can get past the first 10 minutes, Jesus Christ.
No, it's like a fucking Bergman movie.
Life is dooms you. Yeah, I mean, it's, no, it you was, have no chance.
It was like Bergman Scenes from a Marriage or some shit. You know?
Yeah, what the hell? But no, what surprised me at The Good Dinosaur, and I think one reason it was critically panned, it's a boys movie.
It looked like one. I didn't see it.
It's about manhood. And growing up with and your father, you know, wanting you to be this, you know, growing up tough and everything. It's a boys movie. It's very pro fathers and, you know, the kind of like a manhood thing. And I think that's why I was Inside Out was the girls movie.
Yeah, Inside Out, it sounded like a girls movie.
It is. And it's Amy Poehler playing the same obnoxious character that she plays on Parks and Recreation, the pushy, you know, pushy broad in charge or whatever. Yeah. It's like, you know, bossy, I guess, was the big social media swear word on it. But no, I actually enjoyed that. But, I mean, still, I'm going to tell you, no Pixar movie is as effective as CJ7.
No, it's not. And
I might put The Incredibles close, but nah, I'd rather watch CJ7.
The Incredibles is the only Pixar movie I've watched multiple times.
Yeah, that's a brilliant movie. And yeah, CJ7 is like...
It does Watchmen better than Watchmen, in my opinion.
Does Fantastic Four better than the Fox?
Right.
Better Marvel. Do. Better Marvel comic movie.
I'm sure. I'm sure there are Fantastic Four porn spoofs that are better than the. You know.
You might be right. I got a friend who's an expert on that stuff. Yeah. Our friend's over at the CineSludge podcast. I don't think they've done a new episode in a year, but he would be able to tell you.
Yes.
Maybe right. Z could tell you, but yeah, there's. I say get CJ7. It's very. Inexpensive.
Yeah,
it's
just buy it. Don't
buy it.
Just buy it.
Yeah, you'll love it. If you must stream it on Amazon for $3, but I would just buy the disc.
Just buy the disc, you know.
Yeah, you're going to watch it again.
Physical media is fucking dying. Give it, throw it a bone. You know, I went to Barnes & Noble and Jesus, it was the DVD section was a third of what it was.
I canceled my membership with them. I didn't renew. And usually I had it for the Criterion stuff. Yeah, Criterion's not even putting out stuff.
I've been buying more Masters of Cinema than Criterion lately.
Right. It's just it's not worth it.
Like
it's...
Masters of Cinema, their release of Dragon Inn and Touch of Zen, stunning.
Yeah, I have to get those.
Oh, you have to get it. The Dragon Inn Blu-ray is absolute gold.
I bet.
Oh my gosh, I was like. What's Criterion doing? They're not putting out stuff like this. They need to be putting out these kinds of movies.
Why is this coming out in England?
Why are they putting out, you know, The Graduate on Blue? Who cares? How many different editions of The Graduate are there? Why do we need a Criterion edition?
It's like, and there's so many other films that they could be releasing, and they don't even bother.
I know. It's, they've been picking... They've been really boring lately. And, you know, there have been a couple things I've bought here and there. But, you know, but Masters of Cinema has been getting more of my money. You know,
King Who, I'm there. I gotta order that stuff.
Oh, dude, the Dragon Inn Blu-ray was a revelation.
Criterion is like Earth, Wind, Fire, and Little Brother.
Yeah. Like what do they have coming up? Let's see. I'm going to their coming soon. Okay, The Player. Great, whatever.
Ooh.
You know, available.
Hollywood's so dumb, yeah, because you keep making dumb crap.
Yeah, exactly. Let's see, we have The Player, The Naked Island, In a Lonely Place, Easy Rider, which has already been out. They're just putting out a Brief Encounter. They've put that out before. The Kennedy Films of Robert Drew and Associates might be interesting. I don't know what that is, but being a history buff might be. Barcelona, Warner Archives had that one out for a while. Yeah. Only Angels Have Wings, Howard Hawks movie.
There's something right there.
Yeah. I that might be good.
I'm a Hawks guy. But
I love Howard Hawks. But here's the thing: is that been available? Like,
right.
That's my thing. Is kind of like I want stuff that I couldn't get before. Like, okay, Manchurian Candidate Blu-ray. Don't care. You know.
I mean, I have no reason to upgrade from my Warner Brothers DVD.
Have the DVD. It's fine. I'm not gonna. Trade it in.
Here's what Criterion could do. They could put out the early Stephen Chow stuff.
Okay, I will say their Les Blank box set was really good. Like there was a lot of interesting like little mini docs in there, but
right. Well, I got their Jacques Tati box set.
Oh yeah, I need to get that.
Yeah, I had to get that, but it's like why why not do something unique? Put out early Stephen Chow movies like Tricky Brains.
Yeah.
In a box set. Why not? So audiences over here could see them.
Yeah.
Like, they're hilarious. They're still funny. Put out the God of Gamblers sequels that he did with that, where they continued the series without Chow Yun-fat, and they basically had Stephen Chow take over the series. And it was also a sequel to his film, All for the Winner, that was spoofing God of Gamblers. Mm-hmm. And then they just give him the series that he takes over, does God of Gamblers 2 and 3, and it's better than anything Chow Yun-fat did with Wong Jing after that. it's they're brilliant. God of Gamblers 3 is amazing.
Yeah, I need to watch that stuff because I haven't seen anything he's done pre Shaolin Soccer. Like,
wow,
I need to...
it would absolutely blow you away. Because yeah. Shaolin Soccer, I thought, was weak. Like, that's not a favorite.
And well, and here's the thing: I was like 16 when I saw it. So,
right, yeah. Right. No, he's and for me as a longtime fan, he was too old for that stuff. He's playing the same role that he was playing 10 years before, and it's
right.
Like, yeah, I've seen him do it better.
And it was
like,
totally new to me at the time. But you know, I need to see that earlier stuff because everybody's told me, oh, that's the great shit.
Oh, Tricky Brains. Gosh, I didn't think Fist of Fury 1991 held up very well, but Tricky Brains and All for the Winner and God of Gamblers 3 and Fight Back to School parts 1 and 2. I don't care for part 3. You know, there's a lot of good stuff there, and much of it has not necessarily made it into Hong Kong DVD or Blu-ray, although there is a company that is starting to issue a bunch of them, but they're very pricey right now. They're like 20, 30 bucks.
Right.
You know, I mean, what I noticed was the subtitles are more probably truer to the original scripts because they weren't that profane when I'd see them in Chinatown or I'd get the videotapes. But I got the God of Gamblers 2. Back when Netflix was carrying them, I rented the God of Gamblers 2 DVD. And boy, there was language in there I don't recall in the Chinatown version.
Yeah.
Where literally Chow says something like, he's a born cunt.
Well,
and
aren't we all?
For years, I had heard from Chinese women they did not care for Stephen Chow's movies. They thought he cursed too much. I didn't know what they were talking about.
Oh, now you're like, oh, well, he says cunt a lot.
Oh, now they're translating the Cantonese.
That's a word women don't like.
No. <at all. laughs> But yeah, I noticed that the language was a lot more vile in the new DVD translation. So it was like, okay. It's like, there's a little more to it, but God of Gamblers 3, I rented the DVD of that and just thought it was hilarious. There's
okay.
Visual gags.
I'll have to watch those God of Gamblers movies.
I'm really surprised that those visual gags have not been stolen by comedians here, but comedians here aren't that creative.
Yeah, they're not. They don't do visual gags. They're too lazy.
No, it's all, ooh, woe is me, woe is the world shit.
Yeah,
so.
No, it's all like observational stuff.
Yeah, everybody's got them Woody Allen or something, yeah. Or Carlin. It's like, it doesn't work that way.
No, I'm sorry, but you know, not everybody's that smart. You can't.
This is why I would rather watch W.C. Fields than any current comedian making movies at all.
Well, that's why I get into like silent comedy.
I'll tell a movie you got to look for. You can get it on DVD in England. Can't get it in America. Hell's a poppin'. Yeah, there's a torrent out there. You know, if you like to do that, you can find it that way. It's a good one. But Hell's a Poppin' you can get from England is hilarious. It's where the Zucker brothers got all their humor from.
Oh.
It's not the Marx brothers. They got it from Hell's a Poppin'. There was this Ole and Johnson were the comedy team, and they were hilarious. Problem is, once they died, there was a lot of dispute about the ownership of their films, and it's never been resolved. So they did like 3 or 4 films that have never been on home video.
Okay.
But in England, they could put out Hell's a Poppin' because it didn't apply to UK rights. But they apparently did a haunted house comedy that's supposed to be hilarious. It's never been on video. There's just bootlegs around. And those guys were like geniuses. I mean, you watch Hell's a Poppin', it's like, wow, this is where Looney Tunes were getting their jokes from.
Hell's a Poppin'.
It's amazing. I heard about it because David Lee Roth raved about it.
Of course. Of course he did. Whoa, Hell's a Poppin'.
Hell's a Poppin's brilliant. You couldn't see it. You had to pay a guy at UCLA to screen a print for you, so I did. It was great.
By the way, there are rumors that David Lee Roth is no longer in Van Halen.
Yeah, I kind of. He brought the Roth show back, but he pulled all the episodes from YouTube and the Roku channel. But recently he started doing new episodes that are audio only. And put the old episodes all up on Vimeo.
Well, and he did a song that called Ain't No Christmas, and everybody was saying, is this about Van Halen? And he goes, no, it's just a song. And then he goes, and he posted a picture on Facebook, and he said, well, maybe if art imitates life, then maybe it is about Van Halen. Well, and Sammy Hagar and Eddie Van Halen are trading pleasantries on Twitter. So people are wondering if we're not going to get a resurgence of Van Hagar again.
I imagine you probably will.
And, you know, yeah. I'm not the biggest fan of Sammy's stuff, but Sammy's voice has held up a lot better than Dave's.
Well, yeah, I'll pull Eddie Trunk. He goes, Dave never was a good singer. He never could sing.
No, he's a...
What's the point?
He's a personality, you know?
Yeah, he's an entertainer. He's a front man.
And I love David Lee Roth so much. As anybody who listens to this show knows, we're big.
I can listen to David Lee Roth rant maniacally for hours.
Yeah.
Because it's like, I have no problem with it. It's like, he's hilarious.
Yeah, he's really funny.
And I still go back and listen to those old Van Halen albums. And but... You know, it, to me, there's David Lee Roth, Van Halen, and nothing else. So
yeah, I mean, the stuff with Sammy, it's like Jimmy Buffett with fatter guitars. I don't know.
Or Joe Rogan said, it's like music for fat girls.
Yeah.
at clubs that are screaming, you know. But yeah. It's like,
I mean, but you know, Sammy's done great shit, like Montrose.
No, I love Sammy's Montrose stuff.
Yeah.
I like a lot of his 70s stuff. I think he's got the best song on the Fast Times at Ridgemont High soundtrack. That just sums up the whole movie perfectly.
Yes.
And it's I think Sammy captures that late 70s hard rock, his solo stuff, probably better than anything. Mm-hmm. Like, that was the general vibe at the time, Billy Squire and all that stuff. And it was like radio friendly heavy rock. And I think he's got probably the best track on the heavy metal soundtrack.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, that's
Sabbath and Mob Rules is good, but Sammy's Heavy Metal is great.
Yeah.
It's like a lost track from the first Montrose album, which, by the way, the first Montrose album is brilliant.
It's great. It's one of the great American rock records.
You listen to it now, it's still knock you on your butt.
Yeah, the first time I heard it, I was like, oh my God, you know, I can't believe I haven't heard this before, and why haven't more people been pushing this on me?
Should be like a classic rock staple, and it's not.
Yeah,
it's,
like...
It's too heavy for DJs today. It's just great.
Bad Motor Scooter, Space Station Number 9, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, some of it's, they're basically just, you know, like giving an answer to the Who, but.
No, was below, it like Who? Like Kiss, they were saying that Montrose album was like, they were carrying the flag for rock and roll in a time when America was not.
Exactly. It was amazing.
They said all the English bands were kicking our ass, but Montrose was like the one band, one of the few.
Right,
bands.
Right. Oh, it's brilliant. I can't recommend it enough. But yeah, I wouldn't pay $100 to see Sammy Hagar front Van Halen.
But and the thing is like Van Halen at this point, they're a legacy band. You know,
yeah.
I kind of want to hear David Lee Roth's new record he did with John 5 that hasn't come out.
He recorded it like 4 years ago.
Yeah, I know. It's been just sitting on the shelf. Like,
and it's all about the history of American rock and roll, see through the eyes. You know, it's like, yeah, I want to hear it too.
Just bring it out. Just release it. There's no reason it shouldn't be out.
Yeah. Oh, he's no one can really figure out what's going on that guy on in his head.
No,
you know?
he's a total enigma.
He's like the Charles Manson of rock and roll.
He really is.
Yeah,
I don't think Eddie knows what's going on.
I don't think Eddie knows. Eddie doesn't know much of anything.
Yeah, I don't know. But here's the thing: would Sammy come back without Michael Anthony? Because he's playing with Michael Anthony right now.
I know he's very loyal to Michael Anthony.
Yeah. So
and you join up with Eddie, you gotta have Wolfie on bass.
You gotta have Wolfie. Wolfie's also playing in Tremonti too. So.
Right. To me, it's like my wife is like, it's not really Van Halen without Anthony Michael Anthony in there. So
I kind of agree.
Need those harmonies, you know.
I mean, so. Eddie's one of the greatest guitar players in rock and roll, as far as I'm concerned. But you know, it's that original lineup, man.
You got to have it. You know,
there's something that feels like nepotistic and wrong about like sticking your son in that slot.
I was always cracking up because on Opie and Anthony back when they did their first reunion tour, Opie was like, he looks like, you know, Wolfie looks like Ron Bennington of Rockin' Fest.
He was way too young. Like when you saw him in those videos and stuff, he just you see these older guys, and then you see this kid playing bass. It's almost like a comic. It's like it's almost funny. Like
well,
so
also
stupid.
David Lee Roth's scripted banter is like, I guess every show you all, oh, sorry, Ed, forgot about the kid when he's doing the fake attack at the heckler that, you know, he can't hear anybody in the audience. He's like, hey, pal, fuck your girlfriend. Whoa. Oh, sorry, Ed.
When I saw Megadeth recently, I saw Dave Mustaine take, you know, talk to somebody in the crowd. I don't do that. But, and I was like, he goes like, listen, I don't come to your house and fuck with what you do. He goes, I don't come over to your mom's house and knock the dick out of her mouth when she's trying to work.
Yeah.
And I was like sitting there going, Dave's not talking to anybody. It's just him doing the tough guy thing on stage.
It's, you know, scripted thing. It's just like Paul Stanley with the laser light.
Yeah.
He did it at a bunch of shows. It's fake.
Yeah. It's just,
there is no laser light. He's just trying to look tough on stage.
It felt fake when I saw it. You know?
Even when David Lee Roth goes, I forgot the fucking words. It was scripted.
Yeah, of course.
He had a whole memorized thing that he did. You know, it's like, yeah, it was all done on purpose. And my favorite was Alice Cooper used to do this thing where he'd talk about, there's a kid with a Marilyn Manson t-shirt. There's a kid with an Ozzy Osbourne t-shirt. You know, and it was all scripted. He did it every show.
Yeah.
There was nobody in the crowd with those. So it's like they can't see anybody. You know?
Yeah, anybody who's been on stage, you know, like when I did plays and stuff, you can't see the audience.
No, not at all. So it's like, yeah, it's the scripted rock star thing to make them look tough.
Yeah.
Although the night I saw The Cult open for Metallica, and Metallica constantly had beer bottles thrown at them. Oh yeah, that wasn't scripted.
I remember the first time I saw Megadeth. Dave asked for a moment of silence for a fan at St. Jude who was dying of cancer or something, or and that he just visited.
Yeah.
And this dude next to me was going, like, just like making noise, like going, fucking bleh! And Dave was going, shut the fuck up, you piece of shit. And then he goes, if you see the guy making that noise, beat the shit out of him. And this guy was right next to me. And then he started looking around like panicking and like, and he goes, this one goes out to the idiot who wouldn't shut up. This is Head Crusher. You know?
Yeah, you're not gonna get much dignity out of a heavy metal crowd, especially like in the late '80s. It was just the worst possible crowd.
I saw some show recently where there was some moment like that, but I can't remember what it was exactly. But anyway, well, I think we're done with CJ7.
Right.
Let's wrap it up. Visit us at MidnightMovieCowboys.com, at MMCowboys on Twitter, Facebook, Midnight Movie Cowboys. Join our group. Get in the discussion. Talk with all the weirdos on our page. And Stuart will probably be back next week, given he gets his shit together and gets a mic. Also
our sister distribution site, PhantomSway.com.
PhantomSway.com. Thank you, John.
All sorts of cool links and columns and other podcasts as well.
Yep.
We are their leading podcast on Monday. So
we
work hard to make sure we get a new show out every week live up to that billing. So
yes, we do. All right. Anything else, John?
That's it.
That's it. All right. Adios.
All right. Mahalo.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to Stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook head over to facebook.com, type in Midnight Movie Cowboys, hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.